Cornell McDaniel Branch against the Commonwealth. Ms. Burroughs, we appreciate you stepping in under this interesting situation that we've got here. But I gather you are familiar with this case, is that correct?
I am, and I do thank the court for allowing me to step in at this late in the game. So thank you, I appreciate it.
All right, you have 15 minutes to present your argument. Would you like to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
All right, you may proceed when you're ready then.
Thank you. Good morning, judges. Like I said, my name is Joan Burroughs. I'm representing Mr. Branch this morning. We're asking the court this morning to overturn Judge Taylor's ruling at the trial court to not take Mr. Branch's case under advisement simply because we think that ruling was
Counsel, this is Judge Alston, and for me, this thing is really interesting, and for me it resolves on particularly one thing. It appears from the record that Judge Taylor was struggling whether or not he had the authority to do what trial counsel was asking him to do under Hernandez, and obviously we had the Starrs decision that came after Hernandez, and the Commonwealth has conceded essentially that if Starrs is deemed to apply, that the trial judge had the discretion to actually do what trial counsel was asking the court to do. I think the case for me turns on what is the significance of the statement of the Joint Appendix, page 38 to 41, where the trial court says, I am not going to take it under advisement, so we need to go forward. Are you ready to go forward? And what does that statement mean? Can you help convince me from your perspective that that statement means that he did not believe he had the authority to take it under advisement?
Yes, Judge, and I think this is the Commonwealth's main argument as well, is that they don't think that he made the decision based on his lack of authority, but simply because, based on the fact that some other reason, he didn't want to take the case under advisement. I would submit to the court that I think looking at the record as a whole and looking at the fact that we had 2.5, essentially, hearings of talking about whether or not Judge Taylor had the authority to take this matter under advisement, I think, you know, we look at, you know, I've found several places in the Joint Appendix where he talks about whether or not he has the authority to take it under advisement, starting at page 28, where he says, I just don't see where I can do what you're asking me to do. And then at page 31, see, I'm not sure I can take it under advisement.
Ms. Burroughs, Judge Humphreys, I think what Judge Alston is asking you is, I think we understand that, and I think everybody would agree that Judge Taylor clearly wasn't sure if he had the authority or not. That of course, has been resolved by Starrs. But I think the Judge Alston's question, which I think is also the question a number of us have, is simply, given that, the fact, once he makes that statement that I'm not going to do it, that can obviously be construed a couple of ways, but one way it can be construed is certainly that whether I have the authority or not, I'm not going to do it. And, of course, Starrs cuts both ways. You got the discretion to do it, but you also have the discretion not to do it. So Judge Alston's question was, how do you convince us that, or how can you convince us that what that statement was basically, I'm something other than I'm simply not going to do it, whether I can do it or not.
Right. I apologize, I didn't answer it in the best way, but I think you really have to look at, especially the, I believe it's at page 40, which is right before he makes that statement, I'm not going to do it. He says, I think it would have been one thing if the matter was continued and nothing else happened. I have a problem whether or not I have authority to do it after he has entered a plea of no contest. I think for him to have said that and then several breaths later to say, I'm not going to do it, that to me says that he felt that he didn't have the authority, and based on that statement previously on page 40, that was the basis for his ruling. And I think, as the court has agreed, the Commonwealth has agreed, I think he did have the authority to do that. I think it just doesn't make sense that he would spend this much time deciding whether or not he had the authority to do this, and then to simply turn around and ignore all of that, ignore everything he had talked about in the previous hearings and what he had just talked about, I think, a page or two earlier, to simply say he wasn't going to do it. The only
let me ask a slightly different question. For the purpose of my question, let's assume everything you just said is correct. Let's assume that the trial court made the decision essentially that I'm not sure I can do it, and that's the end of it. I doubt my discretion to do that, so So that's the basis that I'm not going to do it. Let's assume that to be the case. Why wouldn't this be harmless error as a matter of law? I mean, you don't have a right. The defendant has no statutory or constitutional right to be essentially acquitted after pleading guilty. So why would not, as a matter of law, any error on the part of any judge who misconstrued the law in this regard to be harmless?
Well, I think we have to look at the result of the conviction versus the ability to take the matter under advisement. I think the error in this stems from the fact that Mr. Branch was essentially convicted of this crime without having the opportunity to take advantage of a period of advisement. I understand that the court...
My point is you don't have a right to that. All Starr says is the court has the authority to do it if it wants to. I certainly don't read Starrs. Maybe you can convince me otherwise. I certainly don't read Starrs for the proposition that every defendant in every case, whether they plead guilty, not guilty, or whatever, has a right to ask the trial court not to do its job by entering a judgment. Here he pled no contest, so he's basically admitting all of the facts that would justify a judgment of guilt. So tell us why it's error. What right, statutory or otherwise, has been violated here, given that the consequences of a no-contest plea in the ordinary course of things is a conviction for the charge?
Well, I think that he has a right to have the trial court understand and take advantage of the full legal spectrum of what he's entitled to as an outcome. And I think when you're
operating
the trial...
That's my point is, how is he entitled to this outcome? You need to satisfy us that he's got some sort of entitlement here that's been denied him.
Well, I think his entitlement is to a trial court that understands the full range of the possible outcomes. I think when you're dealing with a trial court that doesn't understand that you have, you know, the trial court thinks you have options A and B, but in theory you have options A, B, and C, if the trial court doesn't understand that, I think that Mr. Branch had a right to have a trial court judge who understood that he had all of these options rather than just being confined to guilty or not guilty. I think that's the right that's been encroached upon
So your suggestion here is that it's some sort of inchoate due process right? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, I think it would boil down to a due process argument at this point. I think the trial court...
That suggests that there's a due process right in every criminal trial for a defendant to have a trial court literally not do its job by rendering a judgment one way or the other.
I don't think I understand the court's question in that matter.
Your answer to Judge Alston's question, which was suggesting that there's some sort of a due process involvement here, I think the natural result of that extension of logic is simply that defendants have, every criminal defendant in every case, no matter the charge, no matter the amount of evidence or what their plea is, has a constitutional right to have the trial court literally not do its job by rendering a judgment one way or the other. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I think I'm simply suggesting that every criminal defendant has a right to a judge who understands the full panoply of possible outcomes and the full a trial court that understands the full breadth and depth of its jurisdiction. I think that the defendant certainly has a due process right to that in that regard as well. I think that he has...
In a harmless, let's assume that there's error here on the part of the trial court. In a harmless error analysis, typically non-constitutional harmless error is defined as whether or not you can determine without the error, the conviction would not have occurred. Well, here we don't have that. I mean, we have a guilty plea. So, in the ordinary course of things, you would expect a conviction to occur. So, I'm trying to understand how this error could be anything but harmless, assuming given your proposition that it's error in the first place.
Well, first of all, it is a no-contest plea. So I realize that does open the defendant up to a guilty finding, but I do think that there is a distinct difference between a no-contest and a guilty plea. And I think by not having the trial court operating from a basis of understanding, I don't just have to find him guilty. I can also extend this advantage of an advisement period, deprive him of a very essential right to have an informed trial court make the determination. And if I may, I don't want to deviate away if the court still has more questions about this, but I'd also like to point out, I realize the Commonwealth has raised this point in their brief, and I would like to point out that the rule that the Commonwealth relied on to make this argument is 5A12. I would submit to the court that argument is, in fact, waived at this point. I think 5A12, as this court stated, or as the Supreme Court stated in Callaway, applies only to the petition stage, and since we're well beyond that, I would submit that the Commonwealth's argument is waived on that matter. And if the court would like me to address the merits of the argument as it relates to Starrs and Hernandez and Moreau, I'm certainly willing to do that. Otherwise, I'm willing to I wouldn't mind concluding my argument and allowing the court to move on with other questions or with opposing counsel's argument.
Counsel,
any other questions by the court?
Yeah, I have a question, Judge. Counsel, I understand your 5A12 point. How is it that you're not obligated under 5A8 to ensure that the record is clear and that if you had any question as to whether the judge was ruling on the merits, isn't it your obligation as the appellant to preserve the record in a manner that's clear?
Well, Aaron, we would submit on that matter the fact that we had three hearings on this. The sole discussion in those three hearings was whether or not the trial court had the authority to do this. I think the trial court or the trial attorney, Ms. Davis, in this matter was well within reason to assume that the trial court's ruling, given that discussion leading up to his ruling, to assume that there was no ambiguity on the record, and to the best of her ability as trial counsel, that ambiguity was resolved. So I think under 5A8 that her requirements of trial counsel were certainly met and extinguished at that point.
Any other questions?
Thanks.
All right. Mr. Whitmer, we're glad to hear from the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Judge Humphreys, and may it please the court. The Commonwealth's position in this matter is that the trial court's ruling is as clear as it can be. I'm not going to take it under advisement. And it would require this court to put words into the trial court's mouth in order to conclude that the trial judge was ruling that he didn't have the authority.
Judge Humphreys, let me interrupt you if I can. Hypothetically, had the trial court said the following, I am not going to take this matter under advisement because I don't believe I have the authority to do so. Would that change your argument at all?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We would concede that would place this case under the controlling authority of Starrs, and the Commonwealth's posture in this case would be different.
So basically, it's the use of the word because essentially, I think what we have here is the court, instead of doing it in one sentence, does it in two and says, first of all, I'm not sure I have the authority to do this, period. I am not going to take this under advisement. Let's move on, period. And you think that makes a significant difference?
I think what you have here is we've had an ongoing discussion at trial over whether the court has authority, and that discussion
I'm hard-pressed to conclude that given the totality of the history here and all the comments the trial court did make, I'm hard-pressed to conclude, frankly, that the court made its decision not to take the matter under advisement on any other basis other than it wasn't sure it had the authority to do so and didn't want to be reversed if it did. So,
well, Your Honor, but I do understand that the previous history of the proceedings may lend some color to that conclusion. However, that would require this court to presume error in a situation where it's not at all clear that the trial court erred.
Let me ask you this question, Mr. Whitmer. It's rather clear to me that the whole issue that was before the trial court was whether or not the trial judge, Judge Taylor, had the ability to do what was being asked by trial counsel under Hernandez. Starrs hadn't come out yet, so the trial court was looking at it from the context of Hernandez. You have 2.5 hearings, we can actually call them 3, where the whole issue is discussed as to whether or not the trial judge has the ability to take this matter under advisement. That provides the predicate for what we have here. And ultimately, the trial court says, as I pointed out earlier, I'm not going to take an advisement, so we need to go forward. What would be wrong with the remedy in this case of reversing and remanding pursuant to some sort of order, saying to the trial judge, you do have the authority, if you do decide to exercise your authority, to take the matter under advisement under STARS, and then the trial judge could be clear if he just seemingly did not want to allow the defendant this grace that was being asked by trial counsel. What would be the harm in doing that and getting clarification from the trial judge, if we really need clarification, of what he was intending to do?
Your Honor, that would frustrate the purpose of judicial economy. The rules of court require parties to raise issues at the trial court to obtain clear rulings from the trial court.
But wouldn't we be balancing judicial economy against privileges that the defendant in the context of a trial may well enjoy? Which consideration would win there?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that taking the case under advisement is a privilege the defendant enjoys. It's an act of judicial grace if a court decides to do it, rather than a privilege the defendant enjoys or a right of the defendant. And there's no right of the defendant that has been infringed under any circumstance in this case.
Well, that's why I call it a privilege as opposed to a right. A right is something that a person's entitled to. A privilege is something that a person is granted.
Go ahead, Your Honor.
I was going to say maybe option might be a better word. I'm not sure I agree with the characterization of it as a privilege either, but it's certainly an option the trial court has. I think Judge Alston's question simply goes to what degree, if at all, you know, does a defendant have the right to be aggrieved by the failure of the trial court to exercise that option?
Well, I don't think that the Commonwealth's position is that the defendant is not aggrieved at all, but going back to the actual ruling made by the trial court, there were two possible rulings that could have been, well, there were three possible rulings that could have been made. I'm going to take it under advisement, I'm not going to take it under advisement, and I don't have the authority to take it under advisement, and this case would not be the first case in which, faced with a legal dilemma and the possibility of error, a trial judge retreats into the far safer territory of exercising its discretion not to rule on the law, but simply to dispose of the matter. And, you know, that's one of the reasons the Commonwealth has pointed out that this is perhaps an entirely unnecessary appeal. And if a defendant is in this position and the trial judge says, I'm not going to take advisement, so we need to go forward, and the defendant in front of an experienced trial judge may well know that if he asks for clarification, an experienced trial judge will realize what is going on and say, I'm making a discretionary ruling.
Experienced counsel may well say that I think I need not say any more on this because I've had three hearings and I'm sort of pushing the envelope at this point to ask again.
Well, I don't know. Judge Alston, I don't think that's true. I think asking for clarification of the ruling is far different from asking the court to reconsider what it has done once it has ruled. I think, you know,
counsel,
Judge Decker?
Yeah, let me just interrupt a minute because your time is running out, and I want to get an answer to this question. You haven't discussed the impact in this whole situation of the fact that the Commonwealth's attorney, the prosecutor, consistently argued that the court should decide this case on the merits due to the nature of the firearm offense. And basically, that got clarified a couple of times, that the prosecutor's position was that the court should not take the case under advisement because because of the nature of the offense. How does that affect the conclusion that we make based on the trial court's ultimate decision?
Judge Decker, I would suggest that that resolving the case using the actual words of the trial judge is as the basis for this court's, you know, determination of what the ruling was, is probably a far sounder basis than looking at the arguments of the parties, which in either case may not have been accepted.
I think what Judge Decker is suggesting, though, is that why isn't the argument that the seriousness of this offense, the particularity of this offense, is such that it is not the kind of case that one should take under advisement, even if you have the authority to do so, as compared to, say, a petty larceny case, that the seriousness of this offense, the nature of this offense, is one that would suggest further that this is not the type of case to be taken under advisement. I think that's the nature of her question.
Your Honor, I think that's a strong argument for, you know, in favor of the trial judge exercising, trial court exercising its discretion in a particular way. It's perhaps, you know, slightly less compelling in a concealed weapons case than it would be in a rape or a murder case, but it is certainly a more serious offense than simply a petty larceny in terms of a potential hazard to.
Well, Mr. Whitmer, I think the dilemma we have here, and Ms. Burroughs can maybe help us out with it, is unlike a sufficiency standard of review where we take everything in the light most favorable of the prevailing party, which of course is the Commonwealth, this is a de novo review of an issue of law, and all we have to go on by way of historical facts is what the trial court said and the context in which it said it. And so, you know, either the trial court was saying, I'm exercising discretion, and in which case we don't have any kind of a stars argument, or the trial court was saying, I have no discretion, in which case the trial court is wrong, and then we have to deal with whether it's the error is harmless or not, or we simply can't make the call, and we do what Judge Alston posited earlier, which is simply remand to the trial court and say, look, you know, you got the discretion, but you either do it or you don't do it, but and those are your options. Do whatever you want, and that's the end of it. So help us figure out which of those three ways we got to go here.
Judge Humphreys, trial courts are presumed to know and to correctly apply the law, and the burden in this proceeding is on the appellant to demonstrate error in the ruling of the court below. If this case is in equipoise, the tie, for lack of a better description, should go to the trial judge, applying the presumption that the trial judge knew and correctly applied the law. And for that reason, we would ask the court to affirm. If I may briefly, we've noted in our brief.
Let me get back to that point, counsel. That's an interesting way that you put it, and I appreciate what you said, but I would venture to say that most trial judges, including me, didn't know what the state of the law was after Hernandez because it was such a mess. And I think Judge Taylor, who I know to be a very, very discreet judge and who is one who is trying to come up with the best answer, was probably struggling as much as everyone else. And to say that he is presumed to know the law, I think, is maybe in the context of something like this, an overstatement of reality. I don't think any of us knew what the law was after Hernandez, particularly with all the things that were going on in the legislature and the discussion regarding Hernandez. And then we got further clarification of stars from stars. And as I indicated earlier, stars didn't even exist when Judge Taylor was trying to make the call in this case. So why would you say that the judge is presumed to know what the law is when maybe all of us were struggling to know what the law was?
Judge Alston, you know, I would return to my previous suggestion, and that's that a trial judge, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place. In this case, the record, the words of the court suggest that the trial judge retreated into safe territory and exercised his discretion not to continue the matter and take it under advisement, but to proceed to judgment.
Thank you.
The one other thing, we've noted in our brief that there is an illegal sentence imposed for the broken headlight violation. The defendant received a 10-day suspended sentence, and that case needs to be whether it was an erroneous sentence or a clerical error in the order. That needs to be sent back so that the trial judge can take care of that and enter an order that reflects a lawful sentence.
Well, doesn't that undercut your whole judicial economy issue? If we've got to remand for that purpose, maybe we need to remand for clarification on the deferred finding as well.
But I do appreciate your candor on that. I really do.
I didn't mean to paint you into that corner, Mr. Whitman, but I couldn't resist.
No, I understand, Judge Humphreys. The compelling nature of a sentence in excess of what is authorized by law is what compels a remand with respect to that particular offense.
And
that's why we request the court do that.
Appreciating your efforts in that regard.
I'm sure Ms. Burroughs is doing a happy dance as she's hearing you make that representation.
All right, Ms. Burroughs, you have 5 minutes to rebut any of that.
Yes, thank you, judges. First of all, in regards to the, I believe the defective equipment, I think that was actually, in Mr. Whitmer's defense, that was already taken care of. It was a clerical error. My understanding is that was rectified at the trial court.
So the order's already been modified?
I don't want to represent to the court anything that may not be true. It's my understanding, talking with Ms. Davis, that it was rectified at the trial court. Again, I have not seen it personally, so I don't want to submit that to the court.
If I may trespass briefly on the court's time, I have been to the computerized docket record of the Richmond Circuit Court within the past 2 weeks, and it still reflects a 10-day sentence for the defective equipment.
Right.
And we'll certainly look into that, Your Honors. I apologize.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Burroughs. Go ahead.
Okay. Your Honor, we would just simply ask this court to consider the totality of the record when determining whether or not Judge Taylor arrived at his decision simply based on discretion or because he felt he lacked the authority. I think, you know, we had 2.5-3 hearings where that is all he talked about is whether he had the authority to do that. The facts were only discussed at the very beginning of the first proceeding and not brought up again they were not brought up again at all. And I think the only thing that changed between those three proceedings was the court's understanding of its authority, and I think that change was the basis for his ruling. And since that, his understanding, I believe, was incorrect, based on Hernandez, Starrs, and Moreau, I think that his understanding was incorrect, and it's that reason that we would ask the court to reverse his decision and remand it. And certainly we're not asking the court to go so far as to say that Judge Taylor has to take this under advisement, which is why I would be in agreement with, I believe it was Judge Alston's proposed order, to just simply send this back and tell him that he did have the authority to exercise discretion accordingly would be the most appropriate course of action here. I don't think that Mr. Branch has some sort of inherent right to have the case taken under advisement. I do think he has the right to have a trial court that understands the full range of punishment, the lack thereof, that the trial court has to operate with. And so it would be for those reasons that we would ask this court to simply reverse its decision, remand it with instructions with regard to his authority to take the case under advisement, and to proceed as he sees fit. So that would be my argument to the court. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. If there are no other questions, the court will adjourn the conference.
Okay, Judge Decker had a question.
I have a question, counsel. How do you address the point that I made to Mr. Whitmer about prosecutor repeatedly arguing that the case was not appropriate to take under advisement?
I realize that she made that argument at least, I believe, it was two separate times on the record. I think the court never actually verbalized its response to that specific aspect of her argument. Judge Taylor simply spend his time trying to decide whether or not he has the authority to do that. And my understanding in reading the record several times, I don't see where he actually addressed that concern of the Commonwealth. And since
counsel, wouldn't that go to the point that if indeed the judge agreed with the Commonwealth, that supports the fact that the trial judge ruled on the merits and not on the fact that he didn't believe he had the authority?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, I think given his statement I believe it was the page before where he said that he didn't believe that I think he said that he had a problem with whether or not he has the authority to do it after he, referring to Mr. Branch, has entered a plea of no contest. I think that speaks more towards where the trial court's mind was at rather than the Commonwealth's arguments. I think the fact the trial court didn't respond to the Commonwealth's arguments in that response, and in fact even said, at the first hearing at page 28, said that he agreed that the defense counsel's arguments were compelling. I think that speaks to his position on the merits of the case and whether or not it should be taken under advisement. He simply thought that he could not take it under advisement.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burroughs. Thank you, Mr. Whitner. We appreciate your argument this morning, and the court will now adjourn to conference.